I'm just going to introduce our moderator and then let him introduce the panelist, and then I'll sit down. Our moderator, Eric Spiegel, is a senior partner at Booz Allen. He runs the global energy practice, which is one of their largest, if not the largest. He's been there about 20 years at Booz Allen, has lived in Japan, in Asia. And so he spent a lot of time traveling through China, India, Japan, and just about every other country in Asia. This is a tutorial. What we'll do is start in the usual fashion that you've seen already in a dialogue with the panelists and the moderator, and then going at some point to questions from the audience. So I hope you enjoy it. Eric, it's all yours. Thank you.
Thanks, Bill. Well, I'd like to welcome you all here this afternoon. I'm hearkening back to my business school days, and one of my professors told me that you never want to be the second session after lunch for anything. And maybe that's true here today, or maybe they just got the wrong room for this one. I think originally it was intended to be a tutorial, and it looked like, from the size of things, it turned into more of a plenary session. But anyway, the panel and I are all excited that you're here and hope we can put on a very enjoyable and challenging and interesting session for you today. Let me start by introducing the panel, giving a little more background. To my right here is Minxin Pei. Minxin is the director of the China program at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. Prior to that, he was on the faculty at Princeton and I think got his PhD from Harvard University. To his right is Lyric Hughes Hale. Lyric is the CEO and publisher of China Online. China Online is an internet-based service providing news and information focused on China. I think in 2001, Lyric was voted one of the top 25 women in small business by Fortune magazine. To her right is Raghuram Rajan. Raghuram is the chief economist for the IMF. Prior to that, he was on the faculty of the University of Chicago and has his PhD from MIT. And as you would expect, all of the panelists have been published and written extensively on the topics of China and or India and Asia in general. So I think we have a great panel here today to focus on China and India. Let me just spend a minute setting up our discussion today. As you can imagine, China and India aren't just big countries. They're big topics with lots of issues, lots of press, lots of books being written about these countries. And so we want to focus that discussion a bit, both with the panel and their discussions, and then later on when we open it up to Q&A. What we're planning on doing, this is about, given a little bit of late start, probably about an hour and 20-minute session. We'd like to do the first 40, 45 minutes with the panel answering some questions and talking a little bit about the issues, and then we'd like to hear questions from the audience, and we'll have various panelists answer that. When we get to that point in time, I think we have microphones down here in front that people can line up at, and we'll also maybe take some questions from the crowd depending on how formal or informal we want to be at that point in time. Let me start just by talking a little bit about China and India. I'll just spend 3 or 4 minutes setting up the issues. But we all know about the enormous populations and the surging economies in China and India. And they're already both considered two of the standout economic powers in the world. The question is, you know, how long will that remain and what needs to happen for that to continue? What are the challenges that these countries face and what are the implications for the governments in these countries, for the companies who are competing there, and also for the implications for developed countries around the world and how they interface and react and what kind of relationships they have with China and India. One way to think about how large China and India are today, if you take a look at their economies and take a look at if they continued on the same pace of growth over the next 30 to 40 years, China would be the largest economy in the world, surpassing the U.S. sometime between 2040 and 2050. India would pass all countries in the world except the U.S. in the same time period and perhaps the U.S. by 2060 or beyond. So together, China and India, by the time 2050 arrives, will be bigger than the next four largest economies in the world, which today would be the U.S., Japan, Germany, and I can't remember the fourth one. But they are tremendously large countries growing at a very fast pace. However, there's not many people out there who believe that this pace of growth is going to go on into infinity. I mean, we know that there are going to be challenges. We know there are going to be bumps in the road, and we're here today to talk about some of those. Some of the ones that we may get into as we go forward are, you know, what needs to happen to the governments and the current political structures in these countries. What about increased competition? Today, India has staked out a comparative advantage in service industries. China has staked out a comparative advantage in manufacturing industries. But the rest of the world now knows they have an advantage and is fast on their heels, other Asian countries, the U.S. and other developed countries. We know that commodity prices may have an impact on the economies in these countries and other countries. The price surge in oil and steel is well publicized over the last few years, but there are dozens of commodities that have increased in double-digit rates over the past few years. And what impact will that have on these economies? There's also strategic issues in terms of how India and China see themselves in the larger Asian political arena and the world arena, and what's the relationship and the competition between those two countries and the rest of the developed world. There are a host of other issues that we'll be talking about, or we may talk about, including things like the environment, AIDS, the unstable social issues in these countries. And those things will be brought up by the panel, and we hope to engage with you in some of those issues as we go forward. So the hope is over the next hour and 20 minutes, we get into some of these challenges, talk about some of the ideas and potential solutions around those, and engage your questions. So with that, what I'd like to do is turn it over. Each of the panel members is going to spend a few minutes giving us their high-level perspectives on this topic, and then we'll open up some more questions.
Thank you, Eric. I also want to thank the Aspen Institute for inviting me here today. I'm really very honored to speak to this group. What's interesting about China is that the perception of rising China as an economic superpower and potentially economic threat, is very, very different, viewed very differently. In the West, that appears to be the case. But if you go to China, you would find the Chinese people up preoccupied with very different issues. So there is a paradox in my judgment. The paradox is, by all measurements, the Chinese economy is doing very well. Growth is very high, almost 10%. Savings rate high. All the macro indicators for China are excellent. And if you look at those macro indicators, you are going to make the mistake most people make, is to project linearly that the Chinese economy is going to surge ahead forever and ever. But at the same time, you would find very interesting and disturbing things within China. That is, in such a good economy, social tensions are rising. There are more and more riots. Every day there are 1,200 riots taking place in China. It grows approximately a double digit, 10% every year. Second, in a good economy, the government ought to feel confident, secure. But that's not the case in China. The Chinese ruling Communist Party is very insecure, is cracking down on the press, is controlling NGOs. It is afraid to lose power. Third, is that if the direction of the Chinese economy is good, then why is such a raging debate within the Chinese government about the direction of the country, the direction the country is going? So if you put the two and two together, you would find that there is something going on that we do not actually understand. And my job today is to shed some light on this paradox. I think that's because right now you see the paradox emerging because of two things. First of all, China has achieved enormous economic growth over the last 30 years. But Chinese growth has huge social costs. And now these social costs are becoming more visible and beginning to have a political impact. Secondly, the Chinese economic reform strategy is centered on this approach. You do the easy things first, and you leave the tough things later on. Now they are confronting with the tough part of the reform. So let me just say a few words about the social costs of China's economic growth, because in the West, you feel about China's emergence largely as a result of China's exports. But within China, you would find that over the last 30 years, this single-minded focus on economic growth has led to massive environmental decay. The numbers are mind-boggling. Every year, China's economy grows by roughly 10%. It's about $200 billion. But if you factor in the costs to the environment, that's about $200 billion a year as well. So the Chinese economy, if you actually have to pay for environmental degradation, the Chinese economy grows precisely at 0%. So this is one. Second, that the Chinese economic growth takes place in a policy environment that diverts, that places a political premium on investing in tangible assets. That's why Western tourists going to China will be awed by glass, new shopping malls, airports, highways, factories, and so on and so forth. That's because the Chinese government, the political logic, political incentive structure in China, encourages local officials to invest in these tangible assets, which are used to measure their capabilities. On the other hand, because it's no free lunch, you've got to move money from elsewhere. So the money is taken away from social services, from public health, education. I'm a Democrat, but I do not want to sound overly partisan. Well, what's especially interesting about the Chinese Communist Party is that over the last 30 years, it has suddenly transformed itself into a party which is more Republican than the Republican Party in Washington. Because using the slogan of marketizing everything, this growth policy undercuts, in relative terms, government spending in education and health, and then gradually shifting all the risks to individuals. So these are, again, the statistics. Today in China, 65% of the population do not have any form of health insurance. 50% of the people who get sick cannot afford to see a doctor. And the Chinese government spends only 38%. But accounts for only 38% of total health spending. The U.S. is about 45%. So in other words, the Chinese government has moved to the right of the most right-wing government in Western democracies.
That's good. Why don't we move over to Lyric?
Okay.
We gotta go fast. Well, when you talk about the social cost of growth in China, you have to think, what would the cost have been of not growing at all? The way that I look at China and India is in terms of globalization. So what I'd like to do is be a little provocative and iconoclastic in what I'm saying to give you a new view of how to look at this. For example, what Mingxin was talking about in terms of the evaporation of the social safety net in China, kind of a strange thing to happen in a communist country, that has increased China's savings rate. And China saves, and then what happens? That money then is not able to be invested by the Chinese financial institutions because they're not really adept at that. So they send that money overseas. Where? To us. And that is what that investment from China is what sustains our consumption here in the United States, which allows us to go to Walmart and buy more stuff that was made, guess where, in China. So it's set up a kind of beneficent, if you look at it from the view, not from on the ground, but the view from 40,000 feet, some of these things have turned out okay. We tend to look at nations and nation states because we think of the world always in terms of the century before we were born usually. And I don't think that's the way the world is anymore. We just keep thinking that way. China has become the factory to the world. That's the fact. And India has become the back office to the world. There has become, instead of nation states, we've differentiated. Before, countries used to try to be all self-contained. And agricultural policies, which protect local agriculture in all of these countries, that's a vestige of the way things used to be. It's not that way anymore. So as long as China does its job and India does its job, actually really the only losers, I think, might be, or the people who are put in a difficult position, are the other countries in Southeast Asia, because they're not as big and as adept, and they don't have the power to price. I think, and I'm going to be provocative here too, that China and India, when you're talking about them on a competitive level, it doesn't really mean anything. But if you want to look at it that way, there is no way that China is going to fall behind India. And I do think hard infrastructure matters, because if you're a foreign company going in to put money into China and into India and the electricity's off 3 hours a day, that makes a difference. And it's not just hard infrastructure. In India, less than half of the women are able to read. In China, virtually all women are able to read. So it's not just, there's an aspect to it which is hard and an aspect to it which is soft. Telecom, if you look at, I think broadband in this day and age, to be competitive, you have to have broadband. The U.S., on a list of the top 20 broadband countries in the world today, the U.S. is number one, China's number two, and India's not even on the list at all. That matters. That really matters. Communications, transportation, all of that in terms of growing, it takes a while to catch up on that kind of stuff. And we all remember what happened with Enron in India and the delay that was caused. When everybody was starving for electricity, the plant, I think, was closed for 10 years after it was built. So that, I think, is an issue. Finally, my final provocative point, I hope, is that I think that what really matters today is the international institutions. And it's the ability of each country, as it exists today, to integrate into international institutions, which will determine its success or failure. Because, for example, the WTO. India was one of the original members of the WTO, and they got all kinds of concessions because this was a long time ago. But China had to fight its way into the WTO, and so they were able to use the concessions that were made to create reforms within China. That helped China to link in to the world trading system, and I think was very good for them. The real question for me is, These international institutions themselves, I don't think the problem is China or India or any. I think it could be, and Peter Beinart, I think, probably spoke about this before, could be that we've outgrown that globalization and China, on the train of globalization, China's one wheel and India's another wheel, but the people who are controlling the traffic aren't real. The institutions they have, we've outgrown them. And that would be the United Nations, for example. We see that, and the WTO, the Chinese don't really take the WTO seriously anymore, although they did benefit from it. So I think I'd like to, and especially since you're from the IMF, I thought that would be a very interesting thing to talk about. What are the things that we need to do so that this whole world trade system, of which China and India are integral parts, will work the way we want it to?
Thank you.
I'm going to come in between, actually. Min-Shin was somewhat negative on China. I'm a little more optimistic. Lyric was negative on India, and I'm a little more optimistic. I mean, I think you have to step back and ask, you know, when in history have two countries of this size grown at north of 7-8% over such a long period of time? I mean, China's growing at 10, India's growing at 8. You could, you know, fine-tune that, certainly subtract a little bit for environmental degradation and perhaps miscalculated growth. But these are phenomenal growth rates, and having them sustained over 30 years, which both countries have, India since 1980, China since probably 77, this is unprecedented in the history of the world. So in that sense, I think these are tremendously successful experiments so far. Of course, what we know is countries are capable of growth spurts. The problem is many countries don't sustain them, and often they run into political and economic constraints when they're growing at such high rates. I mean, everybody remembers Brazil in the 60s, which was growing tremendously fast and then slowed down. Now, Brazil is still a middle-income country at this point, but the issue is, why didn't it keep up its growth rate? And so we need to ask that question for these two countries. What is going to come in the way? Let me focus a little more on China, on India, given the limited amount of time. In India, what has been happening thus far, as far as government policy goes, is the law of unintended consequences. The government has always had one idea in mind and put in place policies to achieve that idea. Often what's happened is exactly the opposite. The government, for example, wanted to encourage labor, labor-intensive industries, so it reserved a lot for small-scale enterprises, saying that you couldn't produce toys unless you were a small firm, because small firms are labor-intensive and so on. What they did is it kept firms from growing, and therefore a lot of firms quit the toy industry because they just couldn't be competitive with the large firms outside. Similarly, to protect labor, it had very strong labor protections once you grew beyond a certain size. Once you grew beyond 100 employees, a whole lot of labor protections came in. So what happened? Magically, India had enormous number of firms with exactly 99 people in them, because every time you exceeded 100, you broke up. So these were constraints the government put in place. The net effect of all this was India has developed away from labor-intensive industries, which is really where poor countries should specialize, but instead developed a lot of expertise in skilled-based industries. Part of the reason is skilled industries. If you have a BA or an MA, you're not protected by the labor laws. Only unskilled labor is protected. The second is that India had some very good universities, the Indian Institutes of Technology that you might have heard of, which created the backbone, in addition to fairly strong public sector firms, which created some expertise in electronics, in pharmaceuticals, and so on. So what has happened is India has a very strong specialization in skill-based industries, not just the software that you hear about, but also world-class biotechnology firms at this point, pharmaceutical firms. You've heard of all the Indian pharmaceuticals making generics, but they're now going into drug innovation of their own. So this has all been good things. But what this means is India needs the soft infrastructure, property rights, a legal system, contract law, all of which at the first world level to support these first world industries. India is a poor country with a number of first world industries. And therefore, what has to happen going forward is the government has to provide the necessary support, not interfere. And one of the good things is it has stayed from interference in some of these industries, but provide the support. And that is something we have to watch out for. The second problem India has is because a lot of the jobs have been created in these very high value-added but skilled industries, it has left tremendous amount of people without jobs, the unskilled people that Lyric was talking about, and they don't have a way of migrating from the very low productivity agricultural jobs that they have to somewhat higher productivity, low skill-intensive industries like textiles and so on, which China is doing. So that kind of growth has to take place in India. For that kind of growth to take place, India has to create the hard physical infrastructure. Now, Indian firms have adapted to the low quality of infrastructure. Lyric was talking about electricity going off. Well, very few large Indian firms rely on the public electricity system. They all have their own generators. This is not cost-effective. Because it's not cost-effective, India cannot compete on the very low value-added products that, for example, China can produce. India cannot compete with the China price. But what India can do is produce higher-skilled products in manufacturing and sustain somewhat higher cost base as a result. So even in manufacturing, India has moved upscale. India's producing cars, India's locally invented or designed cars, motorcycles which are locally designed. But all this implies that very few jobs are being produced. A few months back, Bajaj Auto, which is India's largest auto manufacturer, created a plant in Pune which was highly automated, which employed not one worker without a BA. And the reason it does this is because of the labor laws, because of the fact that it has to move upscale in manufacturing, so we don't get the low-skill manufacturing growth. That is where India has to focus going forward, and what it has to do is deal with all the impediments which are preventing these industries from coming up, including creating solid infrastructure and also dealing with the labor situation, which I'll talk about later when we get, if I get a chance. But the point I want to make is I think these are hurdles that can be surmounted. Whether they are surmounted is the big uncertainty. But I do think India has the capability of doing this and continuing this pace of growth, which may in fact increase if in fact it does all that is needed on the hard infrastructure side.
Thank you. Thank you. You all hinted at the differences in the political systems between these two countries. And let me ask a question that may in some ways be the elephant in the room. Which of these countries has the political system that can deliver the kinds of economic growth that we're talking about here over the next couple of decades? And if one or both of them doesn't have the right political system, what changes need to be made?
Well, I would vote for India. I think people would really question whether the present system in China will be there in 20 years. I think even the leaders in Beijing have that doubt on their mind as well. I want to use an analogy to answer this question. I think China and India are very two different countries, obviously. But if you were a physician and you make a diagnosis about what can bring these two countries to the next level, I would say for China, you're talking about rewiring the central nervous system. For India, you need to provide extra nutrition. In other words, the risks for reforming the Chinese system are much greater than those for giving India the needed dynamism. Because in India, I really do not see how the political system will come apart as it seems. But in China, I can offer you at least five different nightmarish scenarios about how that can actually happen.
No, I think that if you look at China, and going back to my point about the integration with the world trading system, there's been a phrase that's been used recently. I saw in a review about your book, resilient authoritarianism. If China has created something that's different, that's not a democracy, but it's resilient and it has been quite successful in the past, if it's able to continue that, and those leaders are able to continue the integration of China in the world trading system, maybe they have a better chance than you think.
Can I just
question?
Say one
yeah, okay.
If what you say is true, then I would say today we've had about 200 years of industrialization and the political evolution of all kinds of social systems. The dominant political economic system today ought to be resilient authoritarianism. The fact that there is not tells us something about the sustainability of the Chinese system.
Well, I think there's an underlying assumption here that democracy is the ultimate system. We've had a few adventures recently that show that that might not be true in the world. And it could be that what is important, even though we want people to live like we do, we think we have the best country in the world and that our system is the best in the world, but it could be it's not the best in the world for everybody, and it shouldn't be our primary focus to create that kind of system because it might not create the economic benefits that are of truer importance.
I'll give you a thought on the Chinese economic system going forward and then why I agree with Minxin a little more than I agree with Lyric. To my mind, China has done wonderful things in manufacturing. I think going forward, it has to improve the skill-based nature of manufacturing as it moves up. And this means more innovation. It means more competition. Competition it's had in manufacturing from outside, right? But it hasn't had competition in services, which is more domestically focused. If it wants more competition in services, it has to have a willingness of the state to let go a little more. And that means a state which allows perhaps a little more economic competition, but also political competition. Now, in China, I think you get some of that, but perhaps we need more. And the question is how that is going to happen, whether it's going to be evolutionary, which is presumably the most likely way it will go, or whether there's going to be greater changes along the line. I also think that for what China needs, protection of property, for example, why is it that the most successful Chinese entrepreneurs are in real estate, but not in the soft industries, in, for example, pharmaceuticals? I think you need stronger protection of individual property, not just intellectual property, but individual property, and that requires a system which is, in a sense, more tolerant of that, which may mean democracy. It could be a variety of democracy. It doesn't have to be U.S. democracy. For India, I think India also needs a change. But the change in India is a change in mindset, not of the essential character of the system. The system is sort of reasonably flexible, but it needs a mindset in which government is not the insurer of last resort everywhere. Right now, the situation is every time something goes wrong, everybody appeals to the government, come and bail us out, come and do this, come and do that. And what happens then is that people don't take risks on their own without the knowledge that the government is sort of backing them up. And so I think that mindset has to change, and we can talk a little more about that as we go.
I'm going to ask one more question, then I'm going to open it up probably in about 5 minutes to questions. So if you have a question you want to ask, feel free to line up at the microphones, and in 5 or 10 minutes we'll take some questions. One of the things that struck me, Lyric, that you said that reminded me of my experience was that I think you said China will never fall behind India. And a few years ago when I was living in Asia, we had a regional partner meeting where the Indian partners came to Shanghai. I think this was about 2 or 3 years ago. And they were in shock at how China had moved ahead of India. A lot of it, I think, around the hard infrastructure, the airports, the transportation, the buildings, the infrastructure. And they had all been there in the 70s and the 80s. And at that point in time, they thought they were neck and neck. And some of the Indian partners felt that it was game over. Other ones felt that there were ways that they could catch up. Do either of you disagree with what Lyric said?
Well, I would say that in the next 20 years, if you measure relative performance, India will do better than China. And India will not catch up with China because the gap is so huge. By the way, the Chinese economic development level, historically, has always been about twice that of India. So China began with a huge advantage. Second, if you measure micro-level performance, talking about the overall efficiency of the economy, India is already doing better than China. And I give you some shocking figures. If you measure the profitability of the economy as a whole, India is about 15, 16%. China is 8%. So twice. Second, if you measure the input and then output. China has to invest nearly 40% of its GDP to maintain 9 to 8, 10% of GDP growth. In India, it's 27%. So India needs to put in much less. And then third, if you look at the capital market performance, the banking sector, the Chinese banking sector has non-performing loans in excess of 25 to 30%. In India, it's 5%. So if you look at the economic performance at that level, the Indian economy is already way ahead of China.
Hmm. But India has greater inflation and
government deficits.
And government deficits and the amount of interest they pay is something like 30% compared to China, which is 10 or 12.
Yeah, but so that interest is paid in the form of non-performing banking loans.
Perhaps, yeah.
That's about 20-30%.
But I think that then you've got a difference of two systems because banks in China, that's a mistranslation of the word bank. India has real banks.
Yeah. I think this last point is a worthwhile one to pursue. I mean, what China needs is, as Minxin has pointed out, some serious transformation of a variety. The banking system has to become a real banking system which lends, as opposed to, is a fiscal transfer system where the center finds ways to transfer to the provinces, where the provincial authorities do what they want with the money and the center has no control. China doesn't have monetary control right now, enough monetary control, simply because it doesn't have control over credit. because the banking system is not a serious banking system. I think, so there are reasons to believe that India at least starts off on some of these issues a little stronger. So if there is going to be a transformational change in the nature of the economy for China and for India, India has greater flexibility to do it. So if you were talking about stability, I think India would probably be more stable in its growth. China, there are more risks involved. Ultimately, I want to step back to, it doesn't matter whether China grows at 10%, India grows at 8% or 7%. They're both phenomenal growth rates. And both countries are going to face very similar problems going forward. Inequality is going to be a growing problem. They have to deal with it. Otherwise, both countries will have serious political issues. The external world is a serious problem. Both countries are going to increasingly come across protectionist pressures in the developed world. You can't have such big countries growing at 7-8% for a serious amount of time without them coming into conflict in different arenas. As far as that side goes, I think India starts off a little better because India's growth is a lot more domestic-oriented and a lot less based on exports. So China, in fact, needs the world trading system far more because so much more is export-led. Now, eventually India will get there, but China's more vulnerable on that account, which is why it's very important for China's growth that we maintain the system that we have and work as hard as we can to stabilize world growth and make sure it grows and not have the kinds of disasters we had last weekend with the Doha round.
Is there a paradox of reform, though? Because we're talking, is the fundamental question that we're talking about here, is India's political system better for growth than China's ultimately, even if India, we all agree, is a little bit behind China right now? And it seems to me that, let's look at another country as an example, Mexico. As soon as Mexico became truly democratic, reforms ground to a halt. And Mexico has been falling behind now, falling behind particularly China, right, even though they're our neighbors. So is there something, even if it's a somewhat unpleasant truth to look at, is it maybe possible that the political systems, even though we don't like them, are actually more beneficial during this period?
I have another example, Indonesia. Okay. 30 years of very high rates of growth. An economic miracle in the developing world. It did not change its political system. And there's this huge Asian financial crisis and the authoritarian regime collapsed. And look at where the country is. So for every example, I can bring out a counterexample.
Well, if you look in the cross-section, which economists do every once in a while, what you find is there's no correlation between growth and whether a system is an autocratic system or a democratic system.
That's the case.
You can't tell the two apart on growth. Where you can tell the two apart is on stability. Democratic systems tend to be more stable. The volatility of growth is far less. So people have done this different ways to get the answer that they want. But I think if you just stare at the data, it suggests that democracy implies more stability, which in a sense reflects both your points, that it is possible to have higher growth with an autocratic system, but in the longer run, the democratic system is probably more stable.
Yeah, also I say India enjoys its democratic dividend in the international system, because today you find that the West treats India and China very differently. The West is much tougher on China than on India. India is rising, but nobody is talking about the Indian threat. China is rising, and the China threat has enormous persuasiveness around the world.
Right. Mm-hmm. Well, with that, why don't we go to, looks like we have someone who has a question.
Well, actually, I've enjoyed the conversation very much, but I would like to introduce another topic that I would like to hear from. My name is Mark Hamilton. I'm on the board of a 25-year-old organization called the Nuclear Age Peace Foundation. And one of the questions that came up was what might impede the growth of both countries. And one of the questions, we know that around the world, the sectarian divisions, the competition that's occurring more in the world for nuclear weaponry is growing. Certainly India and Pakistan became very close to a nuclear disaster, weapons-wise. There have been various problems along those lines. Is there a possibility that both in the terms of the nuclear weaponry and in general military area that either country or both would find itself because of sectarian violence and splintering internally, or because of external threats, such as China building up its military in relationship to the United States, buildups in satellite weaponry and so on like that, or in the competition between Pakistan and India, that may begin to take the pull on these economies, particularly if you're talking about China, where you said the internal infrastructure decay
offsetting the growth. Just to shorten your question.
My question is there a possibility that the military needs may, in fact, begin to suck up so much of the growth that it would begin to impede the growth?
You mean like in the U.S.? Okay.
Yeah.
Why don't we – who wants to take that one?
Currently, both governments are internally focused, very much so. China, I think, because of the growing inequality that Minxin mentioned, the difference between the coastal areas and the interior western areas, the rural-urban divide, and what they want to do is focus on improving social expenditures and reducing the amount of tension that is caused by this inequality. India also is inwardly focused. The rise of certain states and some other states falling behind, the fact that some castes are falling behind as more and more goes into the private sector. Some castes are demanding reservations, for example, in education, in private sector jobs, so that they can participate in the growth. These are the kinds of things that are focusing minds in India. So my sense is, at least now, it doesn't seem that they're sort of pointing to the foreign threat and saying we need to focus on militarily matching China or vice versa. At least from what I read, I certainly have a better feel for India than China. I don't think people are focused on becoming a military superpower as of now. They're focused on getting the economics straight.
The Chinese government understands very well that in order for the Communist Party to survive, it must maintain good relations with the U.S. It cannot afford to engage in a costly and ultimately losing arms race with the U.S. That's why the Chinese government has been actually very, very moderate in building up its military forces, even though it has a lot more money to spend on its armed forces. So I would deeply discount the likelihood of an external military conflict involving China or India in the next 25 years.
Lyric, do you have any comment on that?
I completely agree with that.
Okay.
And I think, you know, there are also a couple of things. People say, well, it's the energy needs of China that are going to propel it to create a blue water navy and so forth. That's ridiculous. First of all, they can just write a check and get what they want. Also, another thing, again, in terms of how the world it really is, and not looking at it from a nation-state point of view, at least half of the energy that China uses is used to create products that are exported to guess where? Back to us. So it's not that they're just sucking it up for themselves. It's also being used because they're the factory of the world.
Good. Another question?
So to sustain the kind of growth we are talking about, to me, it appears like four things have to be right: large internal markets, the right skill base, the right institutions, and the right policies. The group has commented on both policies and internal markets, but not as much as institution building, like the Securities and Exchange Commission, our Financial Accounting Standards Board, think institution building, or the skill base. It seems like Brazil failed to establish either of those two. Same thing happened in Mexico. Would the panel comment on those two issues with respect to India and China?
Sure. Who would like to start?
I think that if you look into Chinese history and you look at where China was 500-600 years ago, when China was the world's largest economy, I think that the failure that China experienced was not one of technology, because they had access to technology as well, but the real failure was because of the lack of institutions and the lack of institutions that were able to respond to what was the infancy of globalization. And that's why China fell behind. So I think that these institutions, though, if you look at them right now, well, you go to the stock exchange. When the last time I went, the taxi driver said, oh, you want to go to the stock exchange? You mean the casino. So there's a lack of, you know, there's definitely a lack of faith in some of these institutions. But I think that that's developmental. Another, also in terms of intellectual property, You know, 20, 30 years ago, we had the same objections to that lack in Japan. But once Japan developed its own Sonys and Matsushitas and Hondas and so forth, then intellectual property became real for them, too, and I think the same will happen. So I think some of this is developmental. Maybe you'd like to comment, Rodman, about
India. I'd love a comparison of the two countries.
So as we talked earlier, India, having focused more on the skill-based industries, really needs to do two things, which take time. People keep focusing on the physical infrastructure. I think in physical infrastructure can be built in real time. What can't be built are the institutions. One very important institution in India which is falling severely behind is the judicial system. The kinds of delays, the kinds of the nature of the incentives within the system and so on are making the judicial system, in a sense, hold back India's growth. And you can't create judges and train lawyers in real time. There's a gestation period. Another important input for India is the educational system. Now, in India, primary education was always starved relative to tertiary education, which is why you got the kinds of statistics that Lyric put out, which are changing. But what has happened is, as the Indian government has started focusing, rightfully so, on primary education, it has, in a sense, taken its eye off tertiary education, the universities. And there's a severe problem of shortage in terms of university graduates. Everybody hears the number, 300,000 Indian engineers produced every year. Of this 300,000, 290,000 are of extremely low quality. I may be exaggerating a little bit, probably 250,000. But they're trained in universities which are as big as this room. The kind of engineers that you see, people like that, come from a very elite, small group of universities which produce maybe 2,000 students every year. India needs to expand that base because its universities, because its industries need that, and because foreign firms are going in expectation that they will find that kind of input. That will take time. It is not you can't create, world-class universities overnight. So these kinds of institutions have to be created now. Unfortunately, when you have a government which is not looking that far ahead, which is sort of reactive, these things don't take place as much as they should.
I would say that those institutions have to be built on the basis of a more or less healthy constitutional order, an order that provides certain rule of law, certain restrictions on the power of the state. And that's the biggest problem for China, because China, throughout its history, does not have a constitutional order that limits the power of its rulers. And even today, that's the case. So for China to have a genuinely independent legal institution or a genuinely effective regulatory regime in the financial markets or areas of economic activities, then you have to think about the political monopoly of the Chinese Communist Party. Because today, every regulatory agency has a parallel Communist Party organization attached to it. Actually, the party is ruling, is governing the economy. So where will the party go? I mean, I used to believe that development will solve the problem of the party's status over time. But 30 years has gone by, and situation does not appear to be changing. So I'm more and more leaning toward the idea that for China, you really need a complete rewiring of the system, not just patching the system piece by piece.
You all seem to think that the solution to this idea that they need to build institutions is just a matter of time. Is there anything they can do in the short term? Any ideas or solutions you have?
I think it's all connected. That whether you can, I mean, take, I was railing a little bit about the labor laws in India. Now, the labor laws are there in place, I think, in part because there are no other protections for workers. If a worker gets fired, there's no social security, and there's no way the worker can go through the legal system because the legal system takes 10 years to decide a case. So you have rigid labor laws because the rest of the soft infrastructure doesn't work as well. So I think all these need to be sort of fixed in tandem. You can set up special courts for a little while, but you need a more broader-based solution. So, in other words, I'm saying the problem is big. And I don't think there are quick, easy fixes. They have tried some. For example, now India has export promotion zones where the labor laws don't apply. But my sense is you will soon find there will be labor agitation because labor doesn't have protection there. And so if you don't fix the system, it will start erupting in other ways. You need to fix the whole system.
Okay.
Definitely there is short-term solutions you can apply. For example, the banking sector. Of course, you can leave the big Chinese state-owned banks because there are four state banks that dominate the Chinese banking system. Well, because they are necessary for the current political system. What about selling those smaller banks to Citigroup, to Bank of America, and because that way you can introduce competition, you can create a more efficient system of capital allocation. But the government is not doing that, doing that very, very slowly.
So privatization.
Privatization.
Okay.
Or, for example, the new pension fund, the new social security system of China, one thing that you can do to right the problem that you have of the overhang of government-owned shares in the Chinese stock market, which has stunted the growth of the Chinese stock market, would be to put those government-owned shares, and I think this would be a politically probably acceptable solution, into the Chinese social security system so they would be owned literally by all the people rather than just selling them to foreigners. So there are a lot of things you could do.
If I could just disagree a little bit with Minchin on the private. I think there are possible short-term fixes, but one has to worry about other consequences possibly. I think with the behemoths, the big Chinese state-owned banks, if they are run the way they currently run, and you have a lot of competition on the outside, there is a worry of what happens to their lending, and do you create enormous disasters within the banks themselves, which will come to haunt the Chinese. So, you know, increasing competition is generally a good thing, but increasing competition when one big sector has the wrong incentives can be a disaster. One has to be very watchful. So I think you need to reform the supervisory system and the governance system of the banks in tandem with the competitive fixes that you're proposing for it to work really well. So I think, you know, you need more.
And bringing the foreign banks did not help into the picture, didn't help Argentina, right?
looks like we have a couple. I was warned that I needed to look to my left side given the way I was sitting here. Why don't we take the three questions in turn, and then we'll set those up for the panel. Go ahead.
A recent magazine article in the United States was headlined, "Will China Get Rich Before It Gets Old?" The one family, one child policy has apparently had some significant effect, and on the other hand, in India, I gather the growth rate, birth rate is still high enough that it may even exceed China in population. I'm interested in the panel's observations on the benefits and burdens of a burgeoning growth rate or a declining one. And maybe this ties into what Lyric was saying about putting public assets in social security funds or something like that. But the benefits and burdens of differing birth rates.
Okay. Next question.
I'm currently living in New Delhi, living and working there, and it's interesting. I mean, going even to social events, all of a sudden there's Louis Vuitton bags everywhere and Prada shoes. I heard a statistic recently that every day 700 new cars are on the streets as opposed to bicycles or motorcycles. And sort of whole nouveau riche in Delhi. And I think back to elections a year and a half ago when basically the BJP was outvoted by what is now analyzed as the poor in India who do vote because they felt that the growth wasn't trickling down to them as it should. You have all spoken about the social and political consequences of economic growth. And I was wondering if you could address a bit more as to if you think there's going to be a certain tipping point in which more political consequences such as those elections are going to occur, or there's enough security blankets in place that we can continue as progress.
Good. Last question.
And then this conversation is obviously focused on, you know, the economic landscape of both China and India. I would love to hear a little bit more about, you know, from a social, cultural, human rights perspective, you know, where do you see the societies today and where do you think they will be 20 years from now in terms of the caste system and, you know, human rights in life, you know, for an everyday woman and individual?
Can you just rephrase that question? So I want to make sure I got it right.
Then I would love to hear you guys talk more about the social, cultural landscape and where you think it's going in terms of human rights, and life in India and China for the common person.
Okay, good. Okay, the first question, will China get rich before it gets old? The benefits and burdens of differing birth rates? Someone want to?
Well, certainly, I've actually done a study on the Chinese social security system, so I can speak with some knowledge. China will face that problem, but it's not an insurmountable difficulty for China. There are solutions. I think the solutions lie in speeding up the reform, especially of the financial sector, because the problem of supporting an aging population really depends on productivity, both of the younger generation and of capital. And what makes me worry about China's ability to deal with that problem is that in both areas, you see the Chinese government not doing a good enough job. It is not creating a capital investment system that is producing high, or that will produce high returns. The Chinese, the return on capital in China is very, very low. Second, it is not investing enough in education, especially in educating the poorest people in China. The most shocking aspect about social injustice in China is that the poorest peasants in China actually have to pay their tuition, although the government is not trying to alleviate the problem. If the Chinese government can deal with these two issues, I think it will be a difficult issue, but it will be a manageable issue.
Education. I think as far as India's population growth goes, there are a tremendous number of young people coming on into the labor market over time. They certainly need jobs, but they also need to be prepared for those jobs. So education is tremendously important in India also. Just to give you an example of how much competition there is in India for universities. The other day I met a math teacher, and I asked her, what do you do? She said, I'm coaching a student for an entrance exam. I said, oh, the entrance exam for the Indian Institutes of Technology. She said, no, I'm coaching the student for an entrance exam for a coaching class. I said, oh, the entrance exam for a coaching class for the Institutes of Technology. She said, no, I'm coaching the student for an entrance exam for a coaching class, which will coach the student for another coaching class, which will then coach the student for the Indian Institutes of Technology. This is the amount of competition there is in India for the few university seats there is. One of India's biggest exports nowadays is university students who come all around the world to get a university education because India's universities aren't producing enough places. Now, that's as far as university goes. But we also have a tremendous problem at the primary school level because the government schools are simply not working. So as a result, in the best states, the government schools are working very well. In the worst states, they're not working at all. But the poor are so desperate for education, they're willing to send their children across the street to a private school, paying tremendous fees in order to get their children educated. So I think what you see in India is a tremendous hunger for education, in part set off by the enormous opportunities that people see and want to take advantage of. If they aren't able to take advantage of those opportunities, I think the demographic dividend that everybody talks about in India may in fact turn out to be a demographic curse. I'm hopeful that it will be still a dividend, but it is something that we have to wait and see.
Mm. Very good. That coaching for the coaching for the coaching sounds like private schools in Washington, D.C. why don't we go to the next question, which was around the tipping point for social unrest.
India and China.
India and China.
I do not think in India they have every 4 or 5 years you have election, so the tipping point is a change of government. But in China, the problem is that we do not have those institutionalized channels for expressing your political dissent, discontent, and that translates into violent protests, riots. One statistic that is really shocking is that. Chinese development requires a lot of land. And where does the land come from? The land comes from peasants. So every year, tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of peasants are displaced from land. Today, the number is already 40 million peasants have become landless. And these people have no skills, no jobs, and no social safety net. How are you going to take care of them? The current system does not deal with it. So I think the probability of political unrest in China is much greater than that in India.
What will be the effects of this political unrest? What's the worst case scenario that you can imagine?
I would say that because the Chinese government also maintains a very large police force, so those incidents of unrest will be contained violently or peacefully. What I worry about is that social and political discontent will translate into rampant criminal violence against property and against people. So when there's a crime wave in China, that will reduce investor confidence. That will have all kinds of political implications for China. But of course, that's something way in the future, probably 10, 15 years from today.
Well, you said democracy allows the pressures to come up, but if the pressures don't have any outcomes, it doesn't work that well. I think the problem in India increasingly is the market economy is creating inequalities, which then creates political pressures to redress those inequalities. Now, India's government has historically been very much focused on doing something about it, on an outcome-based, changing the outcomes. And that, I think, is a problem going forward. So, for example, what you have now is the backward castes, who also are somewhat economically backward. They pushed initially in the late 80s for more reservations in government jobs because the government was seen as the path to success. They got that, but it didn't change their economic status that much. Increasingly, as they've got more political power, and India's democracy has been very good in this, in offering wider power, what has happened is they now look to the private sector. How do you get access to the private sector? It's by going through education. But education, again, they're looking for reservation in educational institutions. And the government has just proposed increasing reservations in private educational, in public educational institutions, and perhaps in private ones also. And increasingly, they're demanding reservations in private sector jobs. So what is happening is the pressures are flowing up, and the government is moving, because it's historically attempted to redress outcomes, moving to change outcomes. What it should do, in my view, is move more towards a government which increases the opportunity base, increases access. It has to do the things that governments have to do, which is fix the educational system. And that means, for example, in higher education, allowing far more entry. Why is it that Stanford and MIT are in China but not in India? It implies leveling, opening up the playing field, letting more entrants into higher education. It also means on the primary education front, fixing the incentives that exist in government schools. The reason the poor don't send their children to government schools is at any point in time, one quarter of the teachers aren't present in school. And of the teachers that are present, 40% are not teaching at any point in time. So you need to fix those incentives. It's not money. Across the street, there's a private school where the person who comes to teach in that private school gets one-fourth the salary of the government school teacher. But because his job is on the line if he doesn't teach, he shows up. And the children actually go there to learn because their parents are paying for it. So, I mean, in a sense, it's a microcosm of what the debates that go on in the U.S. today. But it's going on in India because Indian education is not. And I think it has to work in order to reduce some of the tensions, even in a democracy.
Right. I think none of us foresee a storming of the Bastille because of a variety of reasons. But what is maybe more insidious would be a gradual loss of faith and confidence in the government over time that would weaken the authority of the government.
Right. Let's quickly get to the third question that was asked over here, which was around what changes are needed on the social and cultural side. I think human rights were mentioned and the caste system. And maybe we just quickly pick that up in terms of China and India. What's happening socially and culturally?
I think in China, the biggest problem is really growing inequality. I highly recommend a four-part documentary done by Discovery Channel and the New York Times. Excellent. If you buy it online, it's about $40-some dollars. It shows you in stark contrast what is happening to the really, really rich people in China. There's one story about a tycoon building a replica of the Versailles. and just a fleet of Hummers in China. And then you talk about people who really struggle to pay tuition bills. If that trend persists in China, well, income inequality in China already doubled, or increased by about 50% over the past 30 years. China is still not at Brazilian level, but it's approaching that very fast. If that trend continues, you will have a breakdown of social consensus on the desirability of economic growth.
Any other comments?
I think that it's changing across the board. Indian society is changing. Minchin's already talked about China. Four years ago, there was a scandal. An internet-based firm called Telka went after some parliamentarians and some army officers and caught them in the act of corruption, of accepting bribes. What happened? A few low-level army officers got fired, but basically the government went after this firm for, exposing these practices. Recently, last year, we had a repeat where a firm did investigative journalist caught a bunch of MPs on camera accepting bribes to ask questions in Parliament. This time, Parliament basically expelled all these MPs. So I think slowly you're getting a change in public ethics. Investigative journalism is becoming acceptable. And it is asking the right questions. I mean, the TV programs, they're no holds barred nowadays. A government minister comes along and is challenged all the time. It didn't used to happen in democracy 10 years ago. It happens all the time today. So that's on the on public ethics. On the caste system, I've already talked about the fact that castes are getting political power. The so-called lower castes are getting political power, and that's doing a tremendous, it's had tremendously valuable effects in increasing their self-respect and also increasing their willingness to take part in the political process and perhaps eventually affect economic outcomes also. But also, I think what we will see over the next 20 years, both in India and China, is as people get richer and have time, have leisure, you will see a flowering of the arts and culture. You already see Chinese films, which are obviously state-of-the-art. Bollywood has always been very good at catering to the lowest common denominator. But there are arty Indian films which are very good. You'll see more of those, but you'll also see more of Bollywood giving. I mean, Bollywood right now, at any point in time, I'm told in London, a Bollywood movie is one of the top 10, perhaps because of the large Indian diaspora there, but nevertheless, it is making waves outside. Similarly, Chinese movies, Chinese books. I think what you will see is as people become richer and can spend in those countries, there will be a flowering of arts and culture. You already see it in art right now, Indian art and Chinese art hitting record prices because the upper middle class and the rich have the money to buy. So this, I think, is a positive development we should all await.
Yeah, it looks like. Oh, go ahead.
We haven't really talked about the role of technology in helping in terms of freedom and human rights and so forth around the world, and particularly because China is such a wired country, I think that's an interesting topic.
Okay. I think we have time for a couple more. I think we got three people up. We'll take these two questions first. Make sure you phrase it in a question for us.
I'll do my best. I wanted to come back to something that was said, I think, in your remarks at the beginning, which is commodity prices. And I know there's been some speculation, not speculation, but indeed real facts, that there is a very, very strong bull market for most, if not all, commodities. And I think the consensus is largely the migration that's happening in China, bringing millions and millions of people into the urban centers, is creating enormous demand for these commodity prices, which is obviously driving the price up. And I think recently what's beginning to change is now China is beginning to invest in the kind of infrastructure that will allow them to exploit their natural resources at home, and I think has become recently not a friend of our steel industry at all, because they're now able to produce very, very cheap steel in enormous quantities. So I guess my question is, where do you see commodity prices going, and where, to what extent do you see the Chinese and I guess the Indian marketplace being able to develop an infrastructure that can exploit those resources.
Are you talking about oil, ex-oil, or with oil, or
you can include oil in the in the answer, but I think it's broader and sort of speaks to a lot of different commodities: lead, steel, iron.
Next.
I'll actually ask you if you could focus on oil and natural gas. I was surprised that in listing all the constraints to the economies and the economic growth, that nobody really focused on energy as a potential constraint. I know that both of the governments are very focused on energy security, and I was wondering if all the panelists could comment on what they see each government doing. Are they doing the right things to help prevent energy from being a constraint on their growth? And, you know, is there any comparison that we can make? They have many of the same problems and challenges, so thank you.
Very good. And last question?
My question is, since both India and China are really pursuing the development agenda, which is linked to capital to build infrastructure and so forth, I wonder if the current global war on terrorism and the preoccupation we have on arms spending and the Iraq war and possible increase over there, that perhaps this global war on terrorism could, in the long run, hijack the development agenda, not only for India and China, but for many other countries in Asia and Africa that really need the same pool of capital for their advancement. And if there are some long-term dangers here that our present preoccupation with that global war could perhaps have effect to all these countries, including India and China.
So can you state your question?
That could the global war on terrorism hijack the global development agenda, which goes beyond India and China?
Okay. Good. First question about where do we see commodity prices going in China and India, and what can these countries do to build an infrastructure to minimize that?
Well, one thing I would say is that if you have a slowdown in the United States, then the demand will be less in both India and China, and that's what's currently being seen as the likely future here. So I think that there'll be at least short-term a slump in commodity demand because of the slump in consumption from the U.S. But longer-term, as India and China develop, of course we're going to need more and more of those commodities. And energy, the real question is energy replacement. I mean, China and India mean the end of the internal combustion engine. Because if the number of cars that are projected to appear in China and in India actually, if that materializes, there's no way that there are enough oil reserves on the face of the planet or under the surface of the planet to satisfy that. So it could be a very beneficial thing that this demand is going to force us into alternative forms of energy.
As far as China is concerned, the energy issue is serious, again, but not unmanageable. You have to break it down into oil and non-oil. China does not have a problem with the non-oil part because coal provides about 70% of its energy needs. As for oil, I would say that as long as the global oil supply chain does not break down, China will not have a serious problem with that. And as far as China is concerned, energy efficiency gains for China will actually solve a lot of problems. Because China today, another statistic, the energy efficiency in China is half the level of Japan. So if China can bring it up to Japan's level, so China can double its economy while not increasing its energy consumption. The real problem, I think, for both China and India is not energy, but global environmental impact. Because both countries rely on coal. And if no technological innovation is made to reduce CO2 emissions, then God helps 20 years from now.
That's right.
On the commodity issue, I think energy has to be separated from other commodities, and within energy, oil from everything else. I think as far as the other commodities go, yes, we've seen a spike in the price of copper in almost all metals and so on. But in the medium term, I think the expectation is everything will start coming down as supply reacts. And in these areas, you know, for all practical purposes, there are infinite amounts of iron ore, copper, and so on out there. That's not going to be a problem at least in the medium term. I think you will see metals prices falling. You will see other commodities prices falling. Perhaps not as low as they used to be, in part because some of these commodities are very energy intensive, and therefore, given energy prices have gone up, they will also go up a little bit. But I don't think that is where the problem is. The problem really is with energy, specifically oil, where I think we have very limited supplies in the world. It's a non-renewable resource. It's not clear. And there's a lot of uncertainty about how much reserves there are. So I think oil prices are going to stay high, and we're going to have increasing issues about oil supply, whether it meets the increasing demand. I think Minxin has correctly suggested the alternative energy sources are going to become important, specifically from the perspective of pollution, from the environmental perspective. And here is where we have to make tough decisions going forward. How much, for example, nuclear energy do these countries actually undertake in order to reduce the extent of pollution that takes place? And how willing is the world community to support this kind of energy use? So I think there are some interesting issues there. Finally, on this energy security, I have to tell you that I don't understand how any country can get energy security by buying a minority stake in an oil company 5,000 miles from its coastline. It's not clear to me under any circumstance that it has any control over the oil that company produces and has any ability to, you know, grab that oil if, in fact, there's a world quantity shortage. If there's no world quantity shortage, you can always buy the oil at some price. And as a result, it doesn't seem to me that you're better off buying a minority stake in Kazakhstan than buying a share of Exxon, which is far more liquid and far better traded in world oil markets. So I suspect that a lot that goes on under the guise of energy security in India and China is really state-owned oil companies with tremendous amounts of cash being generated from the existing oil resources, wanting to spend it quickly before the government gets its hand on it.
Just one quick comment. Lyric, you made a comment that I thought was very interesting. China and India mean the end of the combustion engine. I don't know if there's anyone from the automobile industry in the audience. They might have fallen off their chair. But, you know, there's been just a massive investment in the last decade in the automotive industry in China. Mm-hmm. And there's a big bet not just on the markets in Asia, but using that market to export to the rest of the world. What's your view? Do you think that that's a fallacy and that the auto companies have made another mistake?
I think they'll just retool over time. It will evolve so that they make different kind of cars than they do today.
So hybrids or...
Exactly, yeah. So I don't think that that's a real problem. They're there because they see it's a huge market. But again, if you just did a prediction of how many cars will be in the streets of Shanghai and how much gas there, it's impossible to supply it with current supplies. So there has to be a change. Is great.
What about India? Any comments on that? They're projecting the same increase in the number of automobiles.
It is. You already see the limits of growth given the infrastructure. As you pointed out earlier, nobody wants to drive in India because driving is really a different art from driving here. Every single open space on the road has to be occupied. It doesn't matter which lane it is. You have two-lane roads with four cars abreast because everybody's trying to get ahead. Right. If the traffic light fails in India, it's a disaster because there's no sense in which you give way to the other guy and then you go. Everybody's trying and then you have gridlock. So I think
the law of physics will ultimately...
You will have the law of physics, but also I think the sheer demands will imply India has to become much more energy efficient. Certainly they've started moving towards, favoring smaller cars, but they will, I think, provide more incentives over time, partly by raising the price of gasoline, but partly by offering incentives for energy efficient cars. So I think that will happen very soon.
Very good. I think the third and final question was around terrorism, perhaps having a role in, I think the word was hijacking growth. Or
I really do not see that happen. I think... In both countries, the governments are so focused on internal economic development. They will not allow that agenda to take over.
I think the question, though, was really the focus of the U.S. government. was that correct, or
yeah.
Western governments?
Yeah.
I think that was what that the gentleman meant. And if you remember, right up to 9/11, the public enemy number one was just about to become China. So when that happened, China came off the list, became more of a friend, cooperated with anti-terrorist efforts and so forth. So I think it made a difference, but maybe in a beneficial way.
I agree with this. I do want to sort of take the question up a little bit and ask the question that Lyric was asking earlier. What about global governance? How do these countries fit into global governance? And do we have to have a wholesale change in the international governance architecture? My sense is we have to really sit back and think, is this the way that our international institutions are going to change? Or do we have to set up new ones? Do we need a new Bretton Woods? As far as my organization itself goes, the IMF, I think we're thinking very hard about this. We're trying to do internal change, to try and see who our members are in true business fashion, what their needs are, and how we can adapt to those changes. But clearly we are circumscribed somewhat by our history. That may be a good or bad thing, but we also circumscribed by the fact that we have a talented staff that, you know, has a certain set of skills. And we need to do things which are consistent with that skill set. Now, maybe for the kinds of problems that come up, we need to create new institutions with new staff, with new skill sets. And so I think what we need to do going forward is rethink this whole issue. Do we have the right institutions?
And for human rights, that relates to that as well. Because maybe the real answer is that human rights is never going to really take root in China for all the reasons that you mentioned.
Political human rights.
Political human rights, exactly.
Not consumer human rights. No. They are flourishing.
Especially in this country. But is it that that's only going to come about through some kind of international institution? Is because the vested interests are just too strong in these countries to permit that to happen?
Very good. Well, I think with that, I think we're at the end of our time commitment, so I'd like to
thank the panel.